are there.
Working.
Okay, it's November 22nd, 1994, and tonight I'm going to be talking with Nancy Anderson, who has lived in Kodiak since 1949 and 1950. She grew up in Sitka, and first of all, since you began your life there, Nancy, what do you remember of Sitka?
Well, when I was in grade school, I remember that it was a very small town, and a group of us lived in what we call the cottage settlement.
Uh-huh.
And I believe this was given, a land lease was given to our people through Sheldon Jackson.
Uh-huh.
So that's where we ended up, and our neighborhood was right in the area where the historical park.
Uh-huh.
We grew up in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Now, a lot of us haven't been to Sitka, so we're just trying to kind of picture what it must look like. Were you close to the water, to the ocean there, where you grew up or in your neighborhood?
Yes, we were. And also in the neighborhood was the Indian River, where the historical Tlingit Indians and Russians had big wars there. But we were very close to the ocean. And it's a very beautiful town.
Yeah.
Mount Edgecombe, Arrowhead, Vestuvia Mountain. Yeah. So there's big mountains.
Yeah.
And it's a very beautiful place. Yeah. Sitka's very beautiful.
Yeah. What kind of things did you do when you were a kid in Sitka?
Mainly we played games. Oh. You know, those days we had battery operated radios. Well, not too many of us had that. So we mainly played games. In our neighborhood, we'd play hide and seek, you know. And
yeah.
Jump ropes, ordinary things that kids did.
Yeah.
Went to the matinees, usually every Saturday afternoon we went to matinees. We always went to Sunday school every Sunday.
Well, that was at the Presbyterian Church,
that was at the Presbyterian Church up there by Sheldon Jackson School.
And I know there's a real fondness amongst the Tlingit Indians for Sheldon Jackson.
Yeah, there was. I believe mainly, like I mentioned earlier, was because of the land lease. A lot of our relatives had land lease for 99 years. We were not able to purchase the land, but we were able to build our homes there. And eventually that, you know, when I went back years later, there was only a few houses left.
And was Sheldon Jackson instrumental in providing the land lease? Or?
I don't remember all that, because I was very young when all that happened, but as far back I could remember Sheldon Jackson did. Through mainly, I think he had educated a lot of the Tlingit Indians, and I assume my parents were part of them. I know a lot of my family were.
Uh-huh. I know earlier, Nancy, you had said that when you went to a movie, there was some discrimination going on, or segregation, that the Tlingits, the natives, had to sit in one part of the theater, and when they went on the bus, they had to sit on a certain part of the... Was that...
Well,
you remember that at all, or was
I
that...
I remember that very distinctly, because... they had the territorial school, which was for non-natives, all through high school. And then they had the BIE, which was for the Tlingit Indians. And after the eighth grade, we were not allowed to go to the territorial school. So we had to pay tuition either for high school to attend Sheldon Jackson or go to Wrangell Institute or someplace as far away as Chamawa. And there was a lot of segregation because of that, because we had separate schools. And when we had one movie theater, and on the left-hand side was where the non-natives sat. The right-hand side was where the Indians were supposed to be seated. And if you cross lines, you know, they just ask you to move to the movie house. So we just stayed in that one section. We never created problems, or nobody else did either. And as far as bus service, we had no bus service at all. We had to walk, although there were buses to provide for the other schools, but all the Indians had to walk.
Was there any resentment amongst the Indians, the Tlingits, you know, knowing this? Did they feel, ever talk about being treated as second-class citizens, or?
Yes, there was a lot of hard feelings, and it seemed like there were always fights after school, especially after school, because, you know, we had to, everything was segregated, so there was a lot of hard feelings.
Huh. Now, you mentioned, Nancy, through your life, you lost your parents at a young age, your father first of all. Do you remember that? You said he went out on a hunting trip, I believe, in the fall of the year?
Yeah, I remember that pretty specific because I remember the date, and I still have his death certificate. He died November 7th, 1935. And there were three other relatives also that drowned at that same hunting trip. And I remember when they were dragging for the bodies, but I don't remember beyond that. I remember the funeral, but beyond that, I don't remember anything much after that.
Now that you mention the funeral and that, now I assume it was it at a Presbyterian church, or did you have it at a a hall or something, or a lodge, or?
You know, I don't remember. Yeah. I think I was 6 years old at that time, and I'm sure there were services at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall there because they always had functions in that order, and there must have been some service at the Presbyterian Church, but I just don't remember.
Yeah. And I guess that was a pretty tough year then, that fall, you know, not having your provider there, your father there to get food and that, and it was a pretty hard Christmas, I bet, huh?
It was difficult to begin with, and it was even more so after my dad had drowned, and then my mother was pregnant at that time, and Corrine was born March following after my dad passed away in November.
Yeah.
There were several of us at home, I believe. There were probably five or six of us.
You have a very touching story, Nancy, about that Christmas Eve that you thought, well, that nobody would get gifts because you were poor and a lot of kids, and then all of a sudden you got a surprise from the kids, the guys from Sheldon Jackson School, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a very touching situation because for Thanksgiving that year, I remember some friend of the family brought us a pig to bake, you know, and beyond that, I don't remember, but Christmas was very, very sad because my mother was pregnant and there was no work and there were several of us at home. And we had no presents underneath the tree. But I remember a knock on the door with carolers outside, and it was the whole student body from Sheldon Jackson. They each brought little trinkets, they each brought a gift, and several different stores in Sitka had provided apples, oranges, turkey, and all the trimmings. So it ended up to be a very delightful Christmas.
Right. Well, now it wasn't long after that that your mother died too, when you were just a kid.
My mother died in April 1943, I believe. I was probably around 13 years old. Close to 13 years old.
Yeah.
It's something I don't want to discuss how it happened, but
yeah.
We were all left orphaned, and so we all went different places, grew up different lifestyles, and so from 1943, my whole family, my brothers and sisters, we have never lived in the same house.
Yes. During your time in Sitka, Nancy, the Alaska Brotherhood, Native Brotherhood, was quite active. You already mentioned that, and you mentioned that before the interview that you had met William Paul, who was a very instrumental. What do you remember about William Paul?
I remember him as being a big Native leader because at that time there were very few leaders from our own heritage, our own culture, but he was one of them. He was more my mother's age group, and I remember him as being a leader, and I probably spoke with him through the years doing AFN conventions, but nothing to any great extent, just to let him know that I remembered who he was, but we were never real close friends.
What are some of the things that the Alaska Native Brotherhood did while you were a youngster in Sitka?
Well, they really fought first, I believe they formed in 1912, and probably 2 years later, the Alaska Native Sisterhood formed, but their main function was to fight for the Indian rights. You know, where we would have segregated schools, where we'd have bus service, and where we would be considered citizens, mm-hmm. which we were not allowed to vote, I believe, till 1924, mm-hmm. because we were not considered citizens. And a lot of this was had to be pushed through Juneau and mm-hmm. then through Congress. And yeah. those are the main functions I remember. But as they expanded, they helped each other, uh-huh. money-wise, you know, and mm-hmm. accidents, probably a lot of different functions. I was never really involved with that until years mm-hmm. later.
Yeah. So, now, I know you have a real a special place in your heart for Mount Edgecombe. So apparently, did you go to Mount Edgecombe then after you went to the Indian school there? And
well, after our parents died, we were all left orphaned. I ended up in Wrangell Institute until February 1947. Uh-huh. And then Mount Edgecombe merged at that time, and we all went to Mount Edgecombe. But I also have a lot of good things to say about Wrangell Institute.
Yeah, yeah. What do you remember about Wrangell Institute? What were some of the special things about this school?
Everything was special. it was very nice because the staff members were more like family. I mean, you know, they treated all of us real well, and they helped us, and they taught us many things. They taught us how to open up a bank account, how to keep track mm-hmm. of our little finances, and they taught us how to cook.
You have a pretty, I think it's happened at Wrangell, the story about when you wanted to help with the cooking, making the cookies. That's kind of a cute story.
All the high school students had to take 1 week off every month. And we ran our own dorm, our own health center, and our own laundry. We all had special details. Mm-hmm. So we did all our own cooking, all our own baking. We took care of our health center. So the student body really did run the school. Physically, we did. Mm-hmm. But I remember I ended up working in the bakery. I first started helping Dorothy Adenson from Craig. And after that, that was my detail to work in the bakery, and that meant baking for 250 students plus 10 staff members. But there were many of us that did that. But I remember that one specific time I asked the cook if I could double the recipe and give each student two cookies instead of one. Uh-huh. He said, well, go right ahead. But we also had a break between 1:30, 2 o'clock until about 4. But I didn't have a break because I baked over 500 cookies. And the cook had kind of a chuckle out of it. He came back and asked me the next day if I wanted to double the recipe again. And I said, no, that's too many cookies, 540, something like that. That's a lot of cookies.
You probably met people at Wrangell that you've probably formed relationships there that continue to this day. I know you did from Edgecombe, you know.
I kind of lost track of some, but like Gertrude Hope from Unalaska, she was in Wrangell, and to this day we keep in touch yet, and there are several others mm-hmm. that we see each other every year.
Now, did Emily Williams go to Wrangell, or you met her at Edgecombe?
She went to Wrangell. Okay. She went there 1 year and she never returned.
Yeah. Now, you probably knew her, though, from before Wrangell.
I knew her when I was going to grade school in Sitka, because we were both, I think, in the same grade. But we became 12. I think when we were in the 5th and 6th grade, we became good pals.
Yeah, and it's now, this last summer of 1994, she and her husband, Michael Williams, who was a priest, graduated from St. Herman's Seminary. They came back to Kodiak for the pilgrimage, and so you were reunited with her after many, many, many years.
50 years.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Kind of touchy because we still remembered a lot of things that we did when we were in grade school, so we were able to communicate, you know, pretty well.
Yeah.
But we didn't get too much of a chance to visit because she had other obligations, being mm-hmm. she was here for that one function.
Right. How many years did you go to Wrangell Institute?
From 43 to 47.
Okay. So that gave you enough time to really get to know the place. And were most of your teachers white, Caucasian, or did you have some native teachers as well? Or at Rangel?
No, we didn't have any Native teachers at that time, but we had a cook that was related to Alfred Hansen from Old Harbor.
Yes. Okay.
His sister Millie was our cook.
Okay.
She was very strict,
yeah.
Very stern, very clean, but she taught us how to work in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And keep a very clean kitchen.
So it sounds like, you know, school was more than just learning academic things like writing and math and so forth, but it also is a place where you learned survival skills like cooking, taking care of yourself, hygiene, getting along with other people.
Yeah, it was very good. They taught us all that. You know, we had to take care of our lockers and our bunks just like the military, square quarters, clean lockers every day. And the dorm had to be immaculate. So to this day, a lot of us still have that good habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really sticks with you. So then you you mentioned the schools merging, Mount Edgecombe and Rangel merged, or?
Yeah, they merged February 22nd, 1947. And then from Rangel Institute, the freshmen and the seniors went to Mount Edgecombe, and the others remained until after the school year. Then after that, they joined us in Mount Edgecombe.
Is Rangel Institute no longer in existence then? Or did they start up again?
They had started up for a grade school, and I haven't kept up. I'm not too sure if it's still in existence or what they're doing with it. It was a very nice school.
Mm-hmm. And how about Mount Edgecombe? Now, here you're back in your home community again after spending about 4 years in Rangel. What was Mount Edgecombe like? In what ways was it different from Rangel?
It was different by far because in Rangel Institute we had about 250 students, and then when they merged with Eklutna, and then we had grade school also, so we're looking at 700 students.
At Edgecombe?
At Mount Edgecombe after the merger, and mainly in Rangel Institute it was mainly Southeast students.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we merged with Mount Edgecombe, then it was all the state of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very different.
Was this your first contact then with like Yupik Eskimos when you went to Mount Edgecombe?
We had a few in Rangel, but not like we did in Mount Edgecombe.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the people that stick out in your memory here from your days at Mount Edgecombe? And why do you think they stick out in your memory?
Many one that sticks out in my mind very well is Mrs. Ripley. She was our history teacher. She made you learn. She was very stern, very strict, but we had her for our homeroom teacher, but she was basically nice, very nice. And after we select her for our homeroom teacher, then from there on, she remained the senior homeroom teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But she taught you very well. And some of my friends, like Christine Littlefield, she was from Rangel, and we still keep in touch after all these years. And other one is Alice Lohr, who's from Kodiak. Those are the ones that I remember very much. And Hubert Finberg went to school in Rangel Institute. And so we were friends years before he came to Kodiak. But he was what you call an upperclassman, you know, so we just passed in the hallways, and we became very good friends later in life.
Mm-hmm. And so these relationships last. Okay, we're going to take a little break. Okay, Mount Edgecombe was a very impressive place for you. You, to this day, you remember things that went on there, and you have a very good feeling about it. What are some of the activities that made Mount Edgecombe such a memorable time in your life?
I think it's student body. I got there and I was with the first graduating class. There were 48 of us, 24 girls, 24 boys, and the senior class was almost like one big happy family. So we helped each other and we had many activities. You know, different students got to run student fountain.
Is that like a
ice cream parlor?
Okay.
You know, soft drink, school supplies. And those that had details there, they were details, they were not paid positions. And whenever they were running low on supplies, they got to do all the ordering. And we had the cafeteria, which is run by a staff of cooks, and the student body got to serve. They had a line for the girls and a line for the boys, and they reversed it, so the girls got to serve on the boys' side, and the boys got to serve on the girls' side. Mm-hmm. And their food was fairly good. But they taught us quite a bit, you know. The gym classes were excellent. They taught the whole class how to do the minuet. I don't know why we had to learn it, but we did. And then they taught us how to square dance. And our group was the best one until we had to perform. Then we got all mixed up. But our junior prom, senior balls were excellent. It was for juniors and seniors only. Mm-hmm. Plus, you got to invite guests, and we had lots of good politicians that came out of Mount Edgecombe.
Examples?
And lots of well-educated students.
Mm. Who are some of the politicians that and state leaders that went to Mount Edgecombe while you were there?
Mm. Well, in my class, there was Richard Stitt, and I can't remember all their names, but some of them have Al Adams. I believe he went to Mount Edgecombe, and he's one of our leaders in Juneau. Mm-hmm. And Bretta Etta, she was in the dorm when I worked there, and she was also a senator, belonged to the House, or one of those. So we had a lot of good educated students that came out of there that furthered your education to be high school coaches, teachers,
okay,
big politicians.
I'm going to ask you the same kind of question I asked regarding your education at Wrangell Institute. Were there any Native workers there? And the reason I ask it is there's a purpose for this. And but at the time you were going, were there any Native teachers or administrators?
We had Miss Davis, who was a home ec teacher. She was a Native, I believe, from up north somewhere. Mm. I never knew her background, but she was a very good teacher, very strict. Mm-hmm. She was one of our own, but she made us learn how to sew.
Yeah.
And she wanted us to do things right. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I don't believe there were any others until later.
Okay, and then the reason I'm asking that, Nancy, is because your brother, Gil Truitt, became a very effective leader at Mount Edgecombe. And you might want to say, do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, my brother went to school in Searcy, Arkansas. And like I say, we were all orphaned, and I think it took 2 years off to earn his own money to continue his schooling. The Alaska Native Brotherhood pitched in to help him finish his schooling, because he came out first of all as high school coach, and then he was a great history teacher. To this day, a lot of students, a lot of kids from around, men and women now, that brag about what a good teacher he was in history. Yeah. And I believe he was assistant principal. Like I say, we don't keep in touch. I just note from things I read and from different people that tell me what's going on. But he went to school for several years, and he finally did retire, but that's what's his goal.
And, well, just last fall, when you and your friend came to the National Guard Armory for the bake sale that was put on by St. Herman Seminary, that one of the couple of the students, when they met you, they said, "Oh, yeah, we remember him."
Yeah. Well remembered throughout the whole state.
Yes. Now, you mentioned him going to school in Arkansas. What was the name of that town in Arkansas?
Searcy.
Could you
S-E-A.
Okay. Okay, S-E-A-R-S-Y. Searcy, Arkansas. He went there to college?
He went there to college, I believe, for 1 or 2 years.
Yeah. Do you have any idea how he ended up down there, so far away from Alaska?
I believe some staff member in Mount Edgecombe recommended that college for what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But like I say, he had to raise his own funds to go, because those days there were no scholarships for any of us. I'm not only speaking for my brother, but for all of us that graduated in that span of time.
Okay. So at Mount Edgecombe, you learned more about being independent and being a leader and dancing the minuet.
Yeah.
Covered many areas. We see in the map of your life that your next place after Mount Edgecombe is at Chignik?
Yes.
Okay, now how did you happen to get to Chignik after, or maybe before we get there, are there any other things you'd like to say about Montichkin?
Well, when I went to Montichkin, I met Viola and Louise Erickson, whose parents are Lily and Henry Erickson, and they're from Chignik. I met them on the Instagram, and they asked what I would be doing after school was out. I said I would have to find a job and a place to stay because I had nowhere to go. So they asked if I wanted to come home with them, and I said, well, what will your parents say? They said, just board the North Star and come on up.
Yeah, aboard the North Star. And yes. What was the North Star?
That was a government supplier that took supply to the villages, you know, mm-hmm. up west, Dutch Harbor, Alaska, probably all the way up to St. Lawrence Island. Mm. And most of us didn't have the funds to travel back and forth, so they had, I assume, a contract to take the students. Okay. And it cost us $1 a meal if we ate.
On the boat there.
On the boat, and uh-huh. So that's how I ended up in Chignik.
You remember that trip from Sitka to Chignik? That's quite a ways there.
Yeah, Kodiak seems far away.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never been out of Sitka other than Wrangell and Juneau and Ketchikan, which were the only places I'd been to at that time. And so I agreed, yeah, I'll go to Chignik. And when I ended up in Chignik, I had $17. But Henry Erickson, Louise and Viola's dad, made sure that we applied for work at the cannery, and we were hired by Emil Norton. That was his first job of being a superintendent.
Okay, and this
so that was the year I met Emil Norton, okay. Years and years ago.
Yeah. And today, and on this day, it's very interesting because now, in 1994, you and Emil serve on the board of directors for the Natives of Kodiak.
Yes.
It's amazing how our paths cross and recross in life. What was the cannery that he was working for? What was it? I know they call it
Chignik Fisheries at that time.
Yeah. Was this Columbia Wards or?
No.
You know, this is separate that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was this your first job then? Your first paying job being working in the cannery?
No. When I was in Wrangell Institute, I had just turned 14 years old, and our principal in Wrangell wanted us all to work, and they wanted to do work in the dormitory, yeah. So he applied for work for all of us in Todd Cannery.
Okay.
And letting the superintendent know that we were all age 16. And when we all got off the two boats, they said, these are the youngest 16-year-olds I ever saw, because most of us were 14 and 15.
Uh-huh.
So we worked long hours, but it was nice.
Uh-huh.
We had fun out of it. You know, we just worked until all hours, and we got to drink coffee. And, you know, we had our coffee breaks, good lunch served, good dinner served. We had our own little dormitory to stay in. So that was the first job I had. Then I worked in Ketchikan General Hospital. I used to hear the different girl talk about working at the hospital in Ketchikan, so I applied for work there. And after I applied, they sent for five of us to work there, and they gave us room and board.
At Ketchikan.
Yeah, at Ketchikan. And so that was very good, and they were strict with us. We could have just well lived in the dorm because they were in charge of us, so they were strict with us, mm-hmm. and they made us learn.
So then you were not new to cannery work when you were working for Chignik Fisheries.
No, I had worked 1 year before that.
Now this is Chignik. There's three parts to Chignik, is there not? Isn't there?
They call one up the bay, down the bay, and Chignik Lagoon.
Yeah. So you were what?
Up the bay.
The bay. Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of work did you do at the cannery there?
I worked at the filler.
Could you describe your responsibility?
Yeah, because they have a big bin where all the fish are stored, and then you line all the fish up where it's gutted, then it goes to the machine where it's gutted, all the heads are taken off, and it's a pretty strenuous job mm-hmm. for someone that's young, you know, and not very strong, because you handle every fish that goes through that line. Mm-hmm. So you get tired at the end of the day, and it was very cold.
Yeah, this was, and mm-hmm. yeah. Now, how long did you work in Chignik?
I worked there one summer.
One summer, and then you came up to Kodiak.
Then I came to Kodiak.
Because of a very important person in your life at that time, Carl Erick.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So you came to Kodiak, got married, and of course you've lived in Kodiak ever since. or did you, with a few departures and then returning again to Kodiak?
Yeah, I wasn't too fond at that time of Kodiak because I was probably not used to the adults. I grew up with nothing but students, and then to come into an adult world was kind of difficult for someone right out of high school. And I had a hard time adjusting because, you know, I was used to 16, 17-year-old students. And so I went back to Wrangell and Sitka and stayed in Anchorage, and I think I was gone for about 2 years, and I missed Kodiak so much that I came back and I never left again.
Nancy, what was Kodiak like in 1950? I believe that's when you first saw it, right? When you first lived.
It was a very small town, more like a village type at that time, and the buildings were all old, unique, pretty quiet. I think the main thing that were going was salmon fishing. Later on, crab came in, and of course the Navy base, but it's more like a sleepy little town. Peaceful, quiet. Everybody was friendly, which they still are, but at that time it was more so because there were mainly local people here at that time.
Of course, this is just not too long after the war, you know, and probably a lot of the people that you met who have been involved somehow in the war probably came up here to, you know, to serve their country.
Yeah, I think, I don't remember their name, but I'm sure there were several that stayed behind because they liked it here. Some of them settled here.
And of course, you raised your kids here too, didn't you? And was it a good place to raise kids, Kodiak?
I think it was because when I came back, the kids were happier after I came back because they were more used to Kodiak and they had relatives, they had all their friends, which they still have that they grew up with. And so my family was very happy to get back, and so was I.
Were you in Kodiak during the 1964 earthquake and tidal wave?
Yes.
Do you remember that event?
Yeah, it was kind of a spooky thing because we had friends at our house and the dogs kept barking and the seagulls were flying high, you know, and all of a sudden you could vaguely hear a rumble. And it was so fierce when it hit that even the cars were moving and the trees were going swaying back and forth. In fact, my neighbor, Lita Eklund, she was at work at the dry cleaners. And when that earthquake hit, her kids were home, waiting for her to get home. And the ground was moving so fast, her two little daughters were hanging on to a stand that kept the oil drums off the ground. It was shaking and rocking so bad. And so we ran over there and brought them to our house, but here comes Lita driving home because she was concerned about her family. And we all headed for high ground by request, and a bunch of us were up by the high school. And we looked out towards Spruce Cape, and you could see that great big wall of water coming in. But then I guess it descended. We never went downtown. We stayed at home with the family, all of us did.
Where did you live then?
I lived on Mission Road then.
Mission Road. So you were safe then? You were safe?
Oh, yeah. But it was spooky, you know. And then you could hear the reports on the radio about Seward burning, you know, docks going down. And we even heard that Kodiak Island sunk on the radio.
And so you looked around you to see if you people were blowing bubbles.
And like you see, I wasn't close with my family, so I didn't make contact, let them know we were okay. But through the Red Cross, my brother Gil did contact to see if my brother Al was okay, if I was fine. We had a sister in Anchorage, and none of us thought to even call and respond to see if we're doing okay.
Where was Gil living at that time?
He was living in Sitka.
Sitka. Well, they say that the World War II changed Kodiak forever, and certainly that wasn't the only change that came. I'm sure that the 1964 earthquake and tidal wave brought about changes that were just irrevocable, that could not be, you know, recovered. What are some of the changes that came to Kodiak as a result of the tidal wave?
The reconstruction, for one thing, was one of the big factors, you know, because everything downtown was wiped out, so that was a major operation there to rebuild the town. And then the crab industry also brought an influx of people, so that was a big change. It was no longer a sleepy little town, as it referred to. Now there was lots of activity. Mm-hmm. And the town grew, and more strangers kept coming in. And to this day, we still have an influx of many people from many different places. Mm-hmm. And it's a big change because the culture is altogether different. It's no longer quite a little village where people go and have cups of coffee, cups of tea, which is the main thing in Kodiak. No matter where you went, there was baked goodies, and there was always tea served. And anymore, it's you don't see that many people anymore that, you know. Because of the reconstruction of town, crab industry, shrimp industry, salmon, and many different people getting fishing sites. So that really did change. It really did change the town quite a bit.
And you were one of those permit holders, of salmon permit holders, and you had a fishing site there at Uganic. Now, you make no bones about it that you don't have this glamorous view of fishing.
No, I ran the fishing site and I had a crew of two.
At Uganic.
I had to be the cook, and I also did canning and, you know, help out of the nets and all that stuff. And in my opinion, that's no job for any lady. You have cold feet, sore hands, your back aches, and the weather is rough. And if a lady wants it, more glory to them, because I didn't like any part of it.
How many summers did you spend out at Uganic?
The total summers I spent there were 10.
Wow. Yeah, okay. You put in your time.
And I didn't like it too well.
I remember writing a story in 1985. And I interviewed people from the south end of the island and these lucrative gillnet sites, and these women had glowing reports about what it was like to live the fishing life during the summer. And I remember your response. This is, they don't tell the whole story, you know. I didn't like it.
I didn't like it for the simple reason I was friendly with quite a few other couples. We were friendly with other couples that fished out there, and so most of us were the same age group. And most of us women felt the same way, that we were very captive. We were stuck on the beach.
Yeah.
And none of us liked it.
Yeah.
Maybe a few did, but the majority of us didn't. But the men liked it because we were under their thumb. Mm-hmm. They got to deliver fish, they picked the nets and run from site to site. Well, majority of it were stuck in the beach. So I literally say I was stuck in the beach for 10 summers.
Yeah. And there's a lot of partying out there too. A lot of people were throwing wild parties, a lot of drinking.
Lots of drinking.
Yeah.
4th of July was a big function in Uganic. Mm-hmm. Everybody from the very young to the old attended this, but we only attended two. And one was on the 5th of July after the party.
Uh-huh.
So really we only attended one.
Yeah.
But they were pretty wild.
So those are 10 years, 10 summers that you would just as soon forget about. And
it's not even like a dream, it's like a nightmare. But I didn't like it because it's really no work for a lady, in my opinion.
Okay. You mentioned crab, and of course the Crab Festival was kind of the sang the praises of the crab as the great fish of Kodiak, and it caused a great boom. And you were involved in the Crab Festival, weren't you?
At one time, I was appointed by the Kodiak board to be a coordinator, because one of our shareholders was a candidate, and they preferred to have a lady that would be willing to coordinate. So that was how I became appointed. To help, you know, sell tickets, sponsor, you know, do all that legwork.
Okay.
It was rather interesting.
I bet. You mentioned Kodiak, and this brings up us to another facet of your very interesting life, and that's your involvement with Native politics, which has consumed quite a bit of your time for the last 25 years. I believe you started out with the formation of the Kodiak Area Native Association. You were on the ground floor of that, I believe.
Well, I believe they started in 1966. There was Harry Carter, Carl Armstrong, Dolores Padilla. I can't remember the other.
Mary Gallagher, Linus, probably.
Mary yeah. Gallagher, Tina Monaco. Most of those that are the elder or some of them that have passed on. And I was encouraged at the beginning to be involved, but I did not get involved until 1969 by the request of Tina Monaco.
Okay.
She encouraged me. She thought I'd be a help, and so I did become involved in 1969.
And what was going on with the Kodiak Area Native Association then? Today we see it as a multifaceted nonprofit association that sponsors social services for Native people. They put on cultural events. They have the clinic for dental and medical. They're very broad in their scope. But in 1969, what it was like, you know, 26 years ago?
It was at the beginning of the formation, mainly trying to get all the villages to form their own chapter, elect their own officers, and then Canon Return would have one from each village be seated on the board. And it functioned mainly on social, health, and education purposes, and was very small at that time.
Yeah.
And through that, we got into the learning process of having seminars. Everybody, all the board members attended seminars.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did some traveling. And so we learned the ethics of the formation and how to proceed, and then we expanded to AFN. But it was mainly in the formation stages when mm-hmm. I was there.
Okay, you mentioned AFN, and I think this brings us into this era of Native sovereignty, Native pride, Natives asserting themselves and taking control of their destinies, and also Native lands, which is connected to that. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. You were, again, on the ground floor of that, weren't you? You were involved in that whole
movement.
Yeah, I was.
The first AFN convention I attended was 69, and that was held in Fairbanks. And there was a big battle of who would be the chairman of the board, because mm-hmm. they were fearful the Southeast would take over, and they didn't want somebody from up north. So it was a pretty big battle without realizing that all the land would be delegated. You know, everybody thought they'd just go out to select land, which mm-hmm. Congress delegated differently. But it was on the ground floor
uh-huh.
where each group, you know, pushed for the chairman from their region.
Mm-hmm.
And Southeast delegated for quite a while because they have many shareholders, I think 18,000 some. And so they hold the bulk of the votes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm just a minute. Okay, I don't want to interrupt any great, profound statement here, so I'm going to end this side of the tape, and then we'll go to the other side for the continuation of this interview with Nancy Anderson. This is Mike Rosted interviewing. This is November 22nd, 1994. We are interviewing Nancy Anderson, who's been involved with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the results of that for the last 25 years. And we're talking now about the formation of the Kodiak Area Native Association and also the AFN, which is an acronym for the Alaska Federation of Natives. Nancy, when did that start? When did that form? Do you remember, and how did it form?
I believe it formed in 1966. I believe Willie Hensley was attending college in Fairbanks, doing some history and doing some research on his homework. And he read parts of something regarding land, where they mm-hmm. sold land, and we were already here, so he figured that we were entitled to the Land Claim Settlement Act. Between him, Abel Noddy, John Burbage, William Paul, and his son was involved, William Paul's son was involved, and so that's how it became about. And the only way they could reach everybody in Alaska with different regions, with all our different cultures, was by a newspaper that was started by Howard Rock.
Mm-hmm.
The Thunder Times, it was all volunteer, just more or less like flyers, until it became a recognized paper. And Howard Rock did a lot of work on that, and he's been recognized
Right.
For all these efforts.
Did you know Howard Rock personally?
I did not know him personally.
Yeah.
He was a big leader, and he was always surrounded by big leaders, you know, and although he spoke to people, very few of us got to sit down and personally talk with him. But we knew his history, and all the people had good things to say about him.
Unfortunately, he didn't get to see too much of what he had started. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we have the AFN, Alaska Federation of Natives, and you've been going to their meetings since day one, haven't you?
I have gone to AFN convention since 1969. And I enjoy it because I like the politics, and I like the social events. They have the many dancers, they have many functions going on, Mundinskum reunion dance, you know, and dancers, Tundra Time banquet. So there's many activities during the week, if you could choose to go to all of them. Plus you get to see all your old friends, and you meet many new people, and you meet a lot of politicians. So I enjoy all of it.
It's exhilarating. Okay, we cannot talk about ANCSA without mentioning CONIAG Incorporated, the Regional Native Corporation of Kodiak Island. You also were involved in the very beginning phases of that corporation, were you not?
I was not. I was on the interim board, and I chose not to go that first election, but I did get elected in 1971, and I served 3 terms on the CONIAG board.
Okay.
And we met a lot of high-powered politicians, you know, like Bill Sheffield had many functions for the Canada group and CONIAG group, and many times we sat with Don Young up at the Kodiak Inn then, and just shot the breeze. We didn't talk politics, but we just got to know, we got to know each other. Frank Mikoski was another one. Ted Stevens had done a tremendous good job for us, but he didn't socialize too much with us.
Yeah.
But he did work for us.
You mentioned before a name that those who have lived in Kodiak a long time certainly remember, and certainly was a person who was controversial and who was very much alive. And the person is Carl Armstrong. Could you tell us a little bit about Carl Armstrong and, you know, how you got to meet him and how you, you know, his role as your working partner?
Carl, in my opinion, and several others, he was a very good leader, and he was a good lobbyist in Washington, D.C., although there were many people that disliked the manner that he went about it, but he did get a lot of land for the Kodiak area, for the Kodiak Island. He got massive amount of land, and in many issues, he was never really recognized, but he was a very good leader. And we had many good leaders from Old Harbor with Sven Hawkinson, we had Ivor Milutin, Perry Eaton, Pete Olson, Jack Wick, Alan Panmera, Harry Carter,
Alan Heitman.
Alan Heitman. Neil Sargent was there at the beginning. So we had quite a change on the CONIAG board, but they did provide very well for training for the Native Claim Settlement Act, because at 1 year after the act was passed, they had probably 110 of us go up to Alyeska for a 5-day training session for the Settlement Act, how it was set up and what we could expect. So it was very interesting. It started at 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 for 5 days. So it was more or less like a crash course. So if you were interested in expanding further, you pretty much had to do it on your own.
When Carl Armstrong died in 1983, I did a lengthy obituary in the Kodiak Times, and I remember talking to Marvin Frost, who was quite involved at that time with CONIAG, and he said something like, I'm going to paraphrase what he said, but he said, maybe people today won't appreciate what he did, but in the future people will recognize what he did and will bless him. You know, he didn't use that word, but will be thankful and grateful toward Carl for the things that he did for the Native people. What are some of the things that Carl Armstrong and his workers, his helpers such as you and Sven and Pete Olson and some of the others, did to really to help the Native people?
Well, our big issue at the formation of Kodiak was to get all the land, mm-hmm. which was successful, but that was mainly through Carl Armstrong's mm-hmm. efforts by lobbying in Congress. We had our differences many times, like any other corporation, but it stayed right there at the table, and we remained friends, but we were able to discuss what we thought with no hard feelings. Mm-hmm. And Carl was a very good leader. He was an excellent lobbyist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was well known all over Washington, D.C.
I think Gene Sundberg said, you know, he brushed arms with presidents, you know.
Oh, he did?
Yes. And you were involved in this, and not only Koniag, but also the natives of Kodiak, which you now are, you serve as a board of one of the board. One of the directors of the board. Could you tell us a little bit about Natives of Kodiak, what some of their projects are?
Well, at the formation, there was no money. It was all given to the villages, and mm-hmm. so we had to lobby Congress for our own grant dollars. Mm-hmm. And our board, through efforts and help from Juneau, Ketchikan, and Kenai, they sent telegram down to me, and I sent it off to Congress, so Congress awarded each of us $250,000 uh-huh. to start, you know, our operating costs and our business license, everything that pertains to a corporation. Then we started holding meetings, and it has expanded. And right now we're involved with the new building, which is right across from the Russian Church in Canada. Mm-hmm. Has the bottom floor for the museum, and that was a dream years back. We started with, I'm going back to Canada, mm-hmm. but there was Mary Gallagher, Tina Montagu, Judith Kanagan, myself, but there's been changeovers, and how that museum started was we set up a bingo fund mm-hmm. that was held in Anchorage. $90,000 a year, we're looking at $2 million, you know? And so, through many efforts, we finally got it off the ground.
Are you saying then that money was being raised for this museum back in the late 60s, early 70s?
Early 70s.
Through bingo?
Mainly bingo, which was being held in Anchorage. Yes, we got a permit on that within Anchorage, and I think we probably, like I said, we probably raised about $90,000 a year.
So that was put in a special fund, and so that accrued interest, and that's helped pay for this building that we're looking at right now.
Yeah,
we can look out the window here and see this building.
It had seed money.
Yeah, that's great. That's amazing.
Yeah, because like Tina Montagu was a big pusher on that. So was Mary Gallagher. Mm-hmm. And they're passed on, and they'd be proud now if they were able to look at that building, because we worked on that for years. Mm-hmm. But it took a lot of effort and a lot of help. Yeah.
So, you've been a busy lady, Nancy, and this is just skimming the surface, but you also were involved, and I'm going to kind of, you know, just hit a few things. There's not any definite order to this, but I'm just going to name a few other activities that you've been involved with, or organizations you've been involved with, and one is the Alaska Tribal Council. Could you please tell us a little bit about that?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, the four named cities, which is Kodiak, Kenai, Sitka, and Juneau, mm-hmm. we were only given one township of land, and then they had, I think, seven reservations in Alaska.
This is through the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, okay.
And so we needed a ground base to try to find out how to get funds to start our corporation, and this is where we ended up getting our $250,000, was through the efforts of mainly Juneau and Kenai. They had attorneys working for them, which we did not. Mm-hmm. And so they encouraged us to send telegrams. We were called Alaska Tribal Council because it's just an ad hoc, mm-hmm. more or less an ad hoc. Mm-hmm. And after we got our grant dollars, we just did away with it. But there were quite a few of us, and we worked very hard to try to get funding. And to this day, George Miller and some of these others from Juneau, I see them periodically, and mm-hmm. we have gone a long ways with starting with $250,000. Now NFK, you know, is well on their feet and they're doing pretty good.
And then the Kodiak Tribal Council, is that also a result of
this? This one's altogether a different one.
Okay, okay.
The reason we got Alaska Tribal Council was because we had to have a name.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no tribal council at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We had to have a name to seek funding
mm-hmm.
in order to hold meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how it came about.
Hmm. Well, most of your time and efforts have been taken up by Alaska Native organizations, corporations, associations. But also you've been involved in other municipal also, even international groups, and one of them was the International Women's Year Conference. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was 1977. I believe there was Esther Mulcahy, which is the banker's wife, and Betty Mullen.
And her husband, excuse me, and her husband was a house, he was a representative.
Right.
Right.
And
Betty Wallen.
Betty Wallen, who was a Vera Mira Pack. Jacobson, who was a school teacher, could not attend, so the alternate was Madeline Poland. But we received letters, I can't remember who from, but we received letters from Anchorage that we were being asked to sit on this women's conference
mm-hmm.
at the whole Pacific meetings here in Kodiak so we could take results back to Anchorage. And after we went back to Anchorage, well then, women from all over the state had met and they were going to be electing delegates to go to Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only four of us from Kodiak and it's, well, who shall we sponsor? And the ladies, well, we sponsor you. And so we all branched out. And I happened to be one of the delegates who went to Houston and there were 18,000 delegates in Houston, all colors, sizes, and name it. Lots of women. And that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Being in Houston was altogether
yes.
a big change.
Yeah.
The temperature there was 100 some degrees when I left Anchorage, it was 10 below. Here I get at the airport, there's a big parking. You know, the traffic was out of sight because when you're from Alaska, face it, Texas is a big place.
Even though Alaska's a lot bigger.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people there.
Yes, big as far as the masses of people. Nancy, we're touching a little, this is a touchy subject here, but you did meet some racism, very severe racism in the outside, didn't you?
Yeah, we did, because cabs were very scarce, and there were two ladies sitting in one cab, and there were three of us that were all going to the convention hall. And we politely asked these women, you know, would you mind if we shared cab fare with you, because cabs are hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at us and they said, well, we don't want to ride with people with dark skin. So we'll get out as well, it's okay with us, you know, we'll take the cabs in. So we did. And then we wore our buttons and
yeah.
I went down, I think, probably about 4 days before the conference started, went to Galveston and, you know, different places. As long as my fare paid, I might as well go early and look around. But we had our Alaska buttons on.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see the people point,
yeah.
That's an Eskimo from Alaska.
And you're not an Eskimo.
Yeah, so that was interesting. Then we bought a car there too, the same thing, you know. They couldn't believe it. And then the cab drivers would tell these people, we have real Eskimos in the car. We don't want to bore them.
Okay. I don't think we are boring anybody. Okay, Nancy, we've covered quite a few topics here about your life, and certainly I would encourage you to get your book started, and I think you already have a title for it, so you must have started it. But you've been through a lot, and you've done a lot, and certainly a living your life in Sitka, losing your parents at an early age and going through some very extreme hardships, has not made you a bitter person, but a very life-loving, people-loving person, and I think that's demonstrated in your love toward the holiday seasons, in particular Christmas. I know that you're fond of decorating your place a month before the season. You're looking very much forward to going to the tree lighting ceremony on Friday. Why do you think that this season is so special to you? And why do you start so early in decorating your place?
Well, I start so early, I guess, because it probably stems back to my childhood. You know, Thanksgiving was kind of sad, and other people start getting ready early, and which we were not. And as far as the holidays, I think after Sheldon Jackson, the whole town of Sitka provided all those gifts and all that turkey trimming, the apples and oranges, it just touched me. And to this day, for Christmas, they're just a special place in my heart. I love the fleet parade. I'm sure everybody else does because there's a big turnout. And I also see a big turnout for the cultural up at the gymnasium. And the ceremony for the Christmas tree lighting, I think it delights people. And it does me, and I don't care what other holiday is. And my kids feel the same way because Christmas is always special. And I always want to share, you know, even canned fish. I don't have that much to share, but subsistence food I like to give to special friends. And I think Christmas is neat, and I think everybody should enjoy it. Everybody should share.
And, you know, you've just opened another door here, and I was planning to close with your comments, but you did mention subsistence food. And you certainly stand out as one of the few people in the area who continues to prepare for the winter, like the natives of old, canning salmon, canning deer meat, berries, and where did you get that from? Do you think it was from Edgecombe or before that at Wrangell, or maybe at your childhood?
It stems from Wrangell because I spent a few weeks with my Aunt Mary Lanting, who's related to John Borovitch, by the way.
Borovitch.
John Borovitch, they're related somehow. But I remember they used to can salmon, and they always put up venison. They always had their own garden, and it's something we never had at home. And for years, I think about all that. All that things that are just there for the taking, and it just goes to waste. Doesn't go to waste, but it's there for the taking. And so after I got involved at Uganda bait fishing, I started doing canned salmon, and then I started to do the kipper, and then the smoked fish. Now we expand to berry picking to make our jellies and our jams. We get rabbits, and we don't get king crab. We barter. They'll trade you for this, that. We put up a lot of halibut, and you know, we just barter around for what we put up. If people want our canned salmon, if they have king crab, well, then we'll make a trade. But I'd encourage people to do that because it's so excellent. It's so good for holidays. It's a special gift for Christmas to your family and to your friends.
So with that tip on buying Christmas gifts or preparing Christmas gifts, we're going to wish everybody listening to this a very merry and happy Christmas, and especially Nancy, who's taken the time to share her life with us. So this is Mike Rosted, and I am saying adios, good night, and I know that you'll enjoy this interview.